Welcome to Crosstalk. I'm Corey Rabin, where we do our part to inspire recovery from addiction and discover a better way. Whether you're considering a life free from substance dependency or already on that path, Crosstalk is here for you. Each episode, we do a deep dive into the experiences and stories of people who have walked the walk of recovery alongside experts in the field to enhance our understanding of addiction and recovery. Our mission is simple: to help you navigate the challenges and celebrate the victories on your personal journey to a better way of life. So buckle up, let's hit the road as we embark on this transformative journey together. This is Crosstalk Podcasts. And welcome. I've never interviewed anybody that I know as long as the gentleman that I'm about to interview. I'm thrilled. My old friend Ernie is here. Ernie, welcome.
Thank you, Corey.
It's so great to be here with you. And you and I met each other, I guess, 41 years ago, something along those lines.
Yeah.
You're in recovery from drugs and alcohol.
Correct.
For 41 years.
That's correct.
When did you celebrate your anniversary?
August 15th.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
It's great. You're ahead of me now, even though I started before you.
Doesn't matter.
What do we have today?
What time did you get up this morning?
I got up at about 6 o'clock.
Then you have more than I do for today.
That's the way it goes.
That's the way it goes.
So, Ernie, what I want to do is I may find out some things that I either don't remember or never knew. And I'm thrilled that you were able to share this with me and with our viewers. Tell me a little bit about where you grew up and how things were at the beginning, just the early childhood life of Ernie.
I grew up in Queens, New York. It's one of the five boroughs for those people that aren't from New York. And my dad died when I was about a year old. So I grew up with a mom. I'm an only child. And I had what I considered to be, or what I thought was, a normal childhood, because I didn't know any different. Or differently. And I remember people always saying to me, oh, you didn't grow up with a dad. Must have been hard. And my answer usually was, it's the only thing I know. I don't know, you know, what it's supposed to be. But I guess I realized it was different when I came home with a bloody nose and my mom wanted to know who did it so she can go and beat up the kid. So at that point I said, no, Mom, you don't have to do that. You know, wouldn't be cool. And I remember as far back, not as far back as I can remember, but I always remembered I was always in search of cool. It was important to me to always be cool. One of the cool kids, hang out with the cool guys, go to the cool places.
What do you mean by cool?
Not lame.
Okay, so you didn't want to be somebody who stuck out as being odd or...
Right.
So you wanted to fit in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sounds pretty normal.
Yeah, be a part of.
Right.
Didn't want to be the outcast. Didn't want to be the kid that people talked about or, you know, that guy's weird.
Right.
You know, I wanted to be in the in crowd like that.
And what age are you thinking of when you started to have that feeling? Early?
Early, probably before 10. And that's sort of an awkward age. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was about 12, I was very bright as a child. And I went to a school in the New York public school system. And some teachers, as well as the principal, who was the top position at that school and at that time, had called my mother to school one day, and I felt like, you know, when your parent gets
in trouble
to school, right? What did I do wrong? As it turned out, they felt that I was very bright. I won't say gifted, but I was very bright. I had an IQ of over 160, and which they tested, so that's why I know that. I don't know what happened, but at that time I did. And they suggested that I take this test for a private school in Manhattan. Now, I grew up in a Well, I was told it was a middle class area. I don't think it was middle class. It was probably a couple of steps below that. And long story short, I was one of, there were 43 children from the New York City public school system that were recommended to take this test. Of the 43, six won scholarships. Of the six, three won full scholarships. I was one of the three that won a full scholarship. So I guess I was pretty smart. And it was a prep school on 54th Street, right off Fifth Avenue. So the people that went to the school at the time were, well, who goes to prep schools? You know, people with means and very bright kids, or people that want to get into good colleges. So my new friends, my new circle of friends, you know, lived at 2 Fifth Avenue in
the village.
Yeah, right by the Arc, you know, nice circular driveway, doorman building. My other friend, Suzanne, lived in a 21-room apartment on Central Park West. These are the people that I'm now hanging out with. When we would go out for lunch, right on the corner at those times, of 54th and 5th, you had Gucci, Prada, Fendi. I don't think anybody where I grew up even knew what those things were or who they are or were or what it represented. And not that it really matters, but...
But you were in a different environment where you kind of didn't fit in?
Well, no. Well, unfortunately for me, and I'll get to why I say it that way, I fit in very well, and I loved it all. I loved it all. So basically, to ease my way in, I did what they did. Because when you hang out with, you know, when you're a teenager, when you hang out with people, you usually do what they do. And if you don't like what they do, you'll go to a different group where they do something else. And then you find your niche, mm-hmm. so to speak.
So what was your niche in those days?
I found people that were, this is going to sound a little pretty. I found pretty people that dressed nicely and liked the things that I did. And maybe they smoked a little pot. If they did other things at that point, I don't think I knew. They maybe tried to find the easy way around things. They didn't study as hard as some of our other friends.
But they were the cool people.
They were the cool people. They were the cool people. They were the people that I wanted to be like. And they accepted me.
How could you keep up with them, considering the fact that these people were living in these, you know, New York City mansions and you were a kid from Queens?
Well, you know, it's funny. When I was, I don't remember exactly what age, but my mother told me this story. She said at some point, as a child, I had told my mother, I thought that she kidnapped me from royalty. And I don't know where that came from. But obviously, I must have been something that I was feeling at the time, because I never really fit in with the people in my neighborhood. I fit in with the people on Fifth Avenue. And so it started.
Are you pretty impressed with yourself, I guess? And
you know, I don't know if I was so impressed with myself, but at that time, I didn't feel, I felt more comfortable with those people.
Right.
Than I did with people. I never felt comfortable in my neighborhood. Mm-hmm. I always felt like I was just different. You know, part of it had to do with me being brighter than most of my friends, maybe a lot brighter. And I always found it easy to get over.
So you're in a prep school, you're in Manhattan, and you're among all this wealth, and you started getting smoking pot and doing stuff like that?
Yeah, a little bit.
Early age? 15?
No, younger, probably 12.
Wow. Okay.
12, but it didn't really continue. You know, it didn't. After I went to the Rhodes School, that's what it was called. I don't know if it's still there. And after 2 years and hanging out with the people that I did there, the dean at the time told my mom that my grades were slipping and they wouldn't be able to give me a full scholarship had I continued, if I wanted to continue. And my mom said, you know, I really couldn't, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I went back to the public school system. So in the 2 years that I spent at the prep school, when I went back into the public school into the ninth grade, I was like two grades ahead. And it fed into my whole, you know, psyche of being
better than everybody.
Well, certainly smarter or further along, mm-hmm. you know, and I was able to help other people get better grades, and whether they, you know, cheated off of me or what have you. And I remember in public school, probably in ninth or 10th grade, I think I started meeting kids as you were walking out of the school towards the schoolyard. And I remember I was asked to chip in for a pint of wine. I think everybody had to put in a quarter. So with three people, I remember, on this one pint of wine, it was called Gypsy Rose, probably the finest thing you could ever drink.
Yeah, no.
I'm being sarcastic.
I know. I mean, my first experience with Boone's Farm apple wine.
Right. Right.
I can sing the song, by the way.
Right. Or MD 2020, Mad Dog nice. 2020, yeah. And only the finest. But it got me to a place that I had never been. You know, that cheap wine. And to take it to another level, we had a great basketball team, the high school that I went to in Queens. And at halftime, well, actually, before the game, we would take this pint of wine, which was neatly wrapped in a brown bag, and we'd go up to the third floor boys' room and put it under the radiator. So at halftime, we would go up and drink it nice and warm. Wow. When we came down, we could probably, you know, dunk ourselves. We didn't even have to watch the team.
So this is through high school? Where are you?
Yeah, I'm probably a sophomore, junior in high school. And then, you know, we went from the wine to the pot. And then somewhere along the line, I found barbiturates. Two and-alls, second-alls. Mm-hmm. Love them. Love them.
Right. They put you into a calmer state. You like the downer kind of thing?
I did, but it was about just inhibitions, mm-hmm. not having any.
Right.
And I found if I took the pills, they didn't smell, because if you drank, people always knew that you were drinking, but the pills were sort of under the radar, you know, and my excuse was, oh, I'm just very tired. You know, and they said, yeah, but you're slurring your words. We can't understand you. I'm like, well, I speak perfectly. Right. How could you not understand me?
And their problem.
I'm just tired. Their problem, not my problem. And that went on for years.
So you go to college?
I did. I was always great in math. So I went to Pace College for accounting. And then after school, when I wasn't in class, I was working at an accounting firm. And at that point already, I was trying to curtail what I used to do. You know, and in the dorms, we would smoke pot and listen to the White album, the Beatles album, and we would play it backwards. And the message was, Paul is dead.
Yeah, I don't think it was the White album, but
Maybe not.
It was I Buried Paul. I think it was in Strawberry Paul. Fields.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. That's right. So I graduated there with a 2-year degree in fashion buying and merchandising. And I worked for a department store in Manhattan as an assistant buyer for about a year and a half.
So that's 81. If I remember correctly, that's a year before you and I met at a 12-step meeting.
Right.
So what was going on with your alcohol and drug use in those days?
Rampant.
What were you doing? Two and all, second all, or were you into Quaaludes?
I think that's when Quaaludes came in. Two and alls and second alls weren't in vogue. And the idea was you wouldn't get as sloppy. My problem was I had to take so many Quaaludes to get me to where I thought I needed to be. You know, with the pills, and again, the pills were because you couldn't smell it, you didn't see it, you know. But, and it was easy. You know, you didn't have to take a bottle out. But to get me to a place, I mean, pills,
I was a great salesman.
I'm still pretty good. I was so much better when I was high.
The places that I went, and, you know, now that I'm in recovery 41 years, I look back and I think, you know, they say you have to keep it green. And I happen to go to a lot of meetings. I'm very lucky that I like meetings, because in 81, things got really out of control for me. I was just taking too much. I couldn't control it. And I was always trying to control things. I remember, it's funny, it just came to me. I had a friend in the 70s that used to say, he used to call me, I had lots of nicknames, but one of them was the human seesaw. Now, why was I the human seesaw? He said to me, you know, you're like a seesaw. He said, you take downs and then you take speeder ups to get you to hence the seesaw name. Never fazed me back then, but years later, I'd say, wow, you know, it's true. And of course, I could always justify things that I did, because I always found people, they either got higher than I did or did more than I did of whatever the substance was.
And they were the
was.
Cool people still.
You know, most of them were.
How involved or not involved was your mom or other family members in your life at this point?
Well, my mom was always she was a great mom. She always supported me. And when I went to my first meeting, which was around 1976, 1977, she actually went to, I think it was Pillanon, which was the Al-Anon version of Pillanon or PA, Pills Anonymous, which I don't think still exists today. And in 81, I went to a 5-day detox. But by that time, since I had already started to go to meetings knowing that I had a problem, and that's, you know, very big that you have to admit that you have a problem and that our lives have become unmanageable, I knew I had a problem. And I thought I was going to meetings to learn how to drink and drug safely, like normal people, you know, because I knew but I always thought that I had a chemical, not imbalance, my makeup was different than yours. You know, if you needed one, I needed two. And now I know, what is it? If one's too many, a thousand's not enough. You know, so there are a lot of slogans in 12-step programs. I love them all.
I have a disease of more.
Absolutely. I have a disease that tells me I don't have a disease.
So 81, you first get exposed to the 12-step meetings.
No, 76. Okay. 81, I went to a detox for 5 days.
And did you go to meetings right after that?
I went to meetings while I was in there. Mm-hmm. When I got because I had started going in 76, I had phone numbers. You know, I had meeting lists. I would go sporadically. I would go to meetings when I was stoned. I remember I always used to wear a suit and tie back in the day in the garment business. And I always prided myself on, I had beautiful ties. And I would maybe drop a couple of pills before I'd go to the meeting, which I did every day. And I would get to the meeting. I would always sit in the back. And they always used to have like tea or coffee and Oreos or Malamars or something chocolate in the back. And I would have them, and I drink the hot tea or hot coffee, which of course would kick in the pill to hit me faster. And I would come to at the end of the meeting when everybody applauds, and I would, you know, wake up and I would applaud, and people would be staring at me. And at first I thought it was because
you were good looking
and my handsome tie, but it was actually because I was, when I would pass out after the hot drink, I would drool that chocolate cookie onto my beautiful tie, and they'd be staring at that. And that bothered me. Didn't bother me enough to stop getting high.
So in 81, 82, you entered the rooms, what month, 82?
Well, I had still, you know, I had been going.
And at some point I would get 30, 60, 90 days. And I remember one time after 90, I would qualify. I would speak at a meeting, share my experience, strength, and hope. And then I felt I needed to reward myself.
What did that look like? Shopping.
I remember I took myself shopping, and then I remembered when I would be stoned and go shopping. It was much nicer. So then I got, you know, whether I drank or drug. You know, when I went to Pills Anonymous, I focused on the pills. And I never was really a big drinker. I mean, yeah, I drank wine, you know, in high school, but never after that. But alcohol was always around. You know, it's legal. You go into a restaurant for a nice dinner. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. So-and-so. Your table will be ready soon. Please have a seat at the bar. Have a drink. Okay? Never really fazed me. I wasn't a big drinker.
And everybody else was doing it, too.
Everybody. And it's acceptable. So now I'm in a, you know, I'm dressed well, and maybe I didn't smoke or drop any pills before I went to the restaurant. Maybe I have 6 months now, right? I sit at the bar waiting for my table in this nice restaurant in Manhattan, and I'm looking at all these beautiful bottles that I never noticed before. Different colors. They have lights from underneath. Unbelievable. Never noticed that before. I don't remember exactly when it was that I started drinking, because I thought my problem was drugs, pills, pot, coke, whatever it was. But now,
you had an
out.
I
switched addictions, because in a short amount of time, you know, I would have a glass of wine before dinner. Then it was vodka and something with dinner or before dinner. So then I would have it before dinner. Then I'd have it at dinner. Within a certain amount of time, when that waiter came over, can I get you a drink? I said, you know what? I'll have a bottle number 145. And then I'd turn to my guests and I'd say, and what are you drinking? Because that bottle was for me.
Interesting how we transfer and don't think anything of
nothing.
So how long did that go on for?
Don't even know. But I will tell you that I've had bottoms on pills. I've had bottoms on coke. I've had bottoms on alcohol, because I've stopped the others. I'm not sure if my bottom on alcohol was worse, but I'll fast forward. I was living on 92nd between Park and Lex in a brownstone. And in my refrigerator, I had a bottle of Bailey's Irish Cream. In the freezer was a bottle of Stoli. On the door of the refrigerator was a stale carton of milk, because I had to have milk for my coffee.
Good. Yeah.
I don't think there was anything else in that fridge. And I remember I found out that you can call a liquor store and have them deliver. That was unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
However, I must have had a couple of pills somewhere, and I took them and then wanted a drink. And when I called that liquor store, one of the most frustrating things in my life happened. He couldn't understand what I was ordering because I was slurring my words. I was trying so hard to tell him what I needed. He couldn't make it out, and he hung up. And I called back, and he hung up, and I called back. Insanity. Insanity. My life is so different today.
Was that a bottom?
One of them.
So did you stop at that point?
No.
So, I mean, you did a little bit more.
So
what led to your deciding that you had enough?
I was in a group therapy, if you will, for addicts. And I would get some time. I think I was in that group for over a year, but I'm not sure. It was a very gray period. I would get some time, and then I would go back out, maybe for a day, maybe for a week. And one of the times that I went back out, I had a, I guess you'd call it a call girl, come to my apartment, because so I didn't have to walk. I didn't really have to talk as long as I was paying. And she came, and I had pills in one hand and a bottle in the other. I swallowed the pills, swashed them down with whatever it was I was drinking at the time. And then a couple of days later, I went to my group. And one of the prerequisites for the group was that you had to be clean and sober. And we would go around the room and we'd say what we said. One of the other guys in the group, he said, "Ernie, you're lying. What are you talking about?" He said, and I don't remember her name, but he mentioned her name. He said, "I had this girl so-and-so to my place, and she was telling me a story about this guy that was going to kill himself. He took a handful of pills, swallowed it down with half a bottle of vodka. She was worried about him. He passed out. She wasn't sure if he was dead, and she left. And she said something about where he lived, or something that I knew was you. So you've been lying to all of us." And I broke down. And this group was in a place that had a connection to the St. Mary's in Minnesota. At the time, the two big ones were St. Mary's and Hazelden. And I managed, and I said, "Well, I can't get on a plane. I don't have the money." And he says, "I'll give you the money." It's the same guy that called me out. He said, "I'll give you the money. You have no excuse." I went there, and 28 days later, I've been sober ever since.
If there is advice that you could give 10, 12, 15-year-old Ernie, you had the opportunity to talk to young Ernie right now, what advice would you give him?
Try to identify as opposed to compare. Everybody's got a story. For me, maybe if I didn't intellectualize as much, I might have gotten things a little sooner. If I was exposed, I think people, places, and things is tremendous. There are a lot of people, from my experience, that, you know, think if they just put down whatever their drug of choice was, and it really doesn't matter whether you sniffed it, whether you drank it, whether you swallowed it, whether you shot it, doesn't matter. But whatever it was, it doesn't matter. It doesn't even matter why, because there's always a reason. I would make any one of you a promise that if you put down whatever it was that was causing you some challenges, some problems, your grades are slipping, your friends are changing, people don't talk to you as nicely as they used to. There are signs when you know that you have a problem. When you get to that point, I don't know if you know, people call it a bottom. One thing I will say is, for me, every time I stopped and then I went back out, my bottom got lower. Every time I stopped and went back out, it took me longer to get back in. I don't know what I could tell myself knowing myself as well as I do today, and I know myself really well. I mean, I can laugh at myself today and joke around, but I don't hear this as much anymore as when we first came in. This is life or death. This isn't about a broken shoelace or a broken nail. This is truly life or death. I could do a whole number on myself and say, well, when I was 15, if I would have gone left instead of right, if I didn't do that, and then it's a waste of time. Okay, whatever point you're at today, at whatever time in your life, we all know when things aren't the way they could be, should be. At that point, when we admit to ourselves that we have a problem, we can't control it. We don't know what's going to happen once we do whatever it is that we do. You know, like I would joke around and say, yeah, one time I did this, that, and the other thing, and I wound up in a cheap hotel in Cleveland with somebody that I wouldn't, you know. We all have that point. And if you can realize that you're at that point, stop. Ask for help.
Thank you so much for being here. And I want to tell the people who are looking at this mug and my crosstalk, I love these. we got these also. Absolutely. So thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. And we'll see you next time on Crosstalk Podcasts.